Tonight we're going to talk about embracing the mystery. If I was going to subtitle this, I would call it An Introduction to Orthodox Spirituality with the subtitle of, Man, that's a lot of paradox. When we talk about mystery, usually we think in terms of something that is difficult or impossible to understand, or we think of Agatha Christie or Sherlock Holmes or something that we're hoping we might be able to figure out when we get to the end. But when we come to the scriptures and when we come to the Christian faith, mystery is a little different. Callistos Ware has this definition. In the Christian context, we do not mean by a mystery merely that which is baffling and mysterious, an enigma or insoluble problem. A mystery is, on the contrary, something which is revealed for our understanding, but which we never understand exhaustively because it leads into the depth or the darkness of God. The eyes are closed, but they are also open. God is hidden from us, but he is also revealed to us, revealed as person and as love. You see where the paradoxes start coming, and there's going to be a lot of them. I guess tonight, more than anything, I'd like you to think that we're kind of on a walk in a state park, and I'm just going to point out a few of the cool sights. Stuff that guys have said a lot better than I ever could, and we're just going to look at some of this together. When I got looking at this and I started getting an idea of what I was going to talk about, of course, the first person I called to go sit down with was George. And I said, if you were going to define mystery, what would you say it is? And he said, the easiest thing for me to say is it's something that we kind of know, but it's still unfamiliar. We've been given glimpses, but we don't have the wholeness of it. And then to kind of expand upon that, it's something that we won't fully know for a really, really long time. In Corinthians, Paul says that we will be gaining revelation on Christ from the ages to the ages. It just seems to keep going and going and going. And this whole thing just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. In the scriptures, Paul uses the word mystery several times. He talks about the mystery of the fact that the Jews and the Gentiles will all be together and will be one group. He talks about the fact that it's a mystery that we will not all die, but that we will all be changed. He says that the church is a mystery, and I think all of us at one time or another could agree with that. But most of the time, he talks about the mystery of the gospel, of Christ, of Jesus. Over and over, this concept comes up. And next week, we'll be looking at more of what Paul is actually talking about. So I guess the question is, why does it matter? Why do we want to even talk about mystery? Why is it an issue for us today? Well, I would say this. We are living in a time where technology is really big. We keep growing in our understanding of things. And the more we understand, the more we tend to think that we fully grasp something. And we sort of set ourselves on a level with it, but it also begins to bring down what we are willing to work to understand. There's a writer named Ken Wilber. Let me add at the start, he's not a Christian. I call him a philosophy of spirituality. I think he teaches at Yale. And in a book he wrote some years ago, he described the spiritual climate in general, not Christianity, but all in this way. He says, "Welcome to Flatland, a purely descended world. We moderns and postmoderns live almost entirely within this purely descended grid. The flat and faded world of endless sensory forms, this superficial world of drab and dreary surfaces. Whether with capitalism or Marxism, industrialism or deep ecology, consumerism or ecofeminism, in all cases, your God, your goddess, is one that you can see with your eyes, register with your senses, wrap with feelings, worship with sensations. A God that you can sink your teeth into, and that exhausts its form. Whether or not we consider ourselves spiritual, we flatlanders worship at the altar of the merely descended God, the sensory goddess, the sensational world, the monochrome world of simple location, the world you can put your finger on. Nothing higher or deeper for us than the God that is clunking around in our visual field. We've kind of reduced it all down to what we can know and understand and grab. And I would suggest to you that this phrase right here encapsulates Christianity's contribution to the situation. God said it, I believe it, that settles it. What's left? We could spend a whole night going into the complexities of that statement right there. But we won't. But what we have done is we have taken phrases like this and said, we live in a world that is increasingly complex. So what we want to do with that is try to come up with easier and easier answers. And answers that are more and more simple and that require not a whole lot of thought. And so we get into this area where we dispute, but we don't want a whole lot of outside the box thinking. We want everything to be right here. God said it. I believe it. That settles it. If you go back in history, it's interesting to notice that the first 1,000 years of the church, all the disputes were about the incarnation, the nature of Christ, the Trinity. It was all around who God is, what he does, how he works. Even in 1054, the big split between East and West was about definitions of how the Trinity works together. That was where everything was. Those were the big debates. It was always centered around God. Jump up to our time. We debate about moral issues, cultural issues, pop stars, Bible verses, all kinds of things, but rarely, if ever, is it about God. I think there's a part of a problem there. Our disputes and sadly our unity now often center on what we believe or think about a particular issue. Because you see, we pretty much think we've got the God part figured out, so we center on specific things. Problem is, a lot of times the conflict is actually with people outside the church, who are the very people that Paul encouraged the Corinthians, don't bother with them, don't judge them, that's not our role. So a lot of times what we end up doing is actually trying to legislate which sins are okay and which sins are not okay. As the church. It's kind of a weird thing. So these disputes become very specific about issues. Just within the past couple of weeks, you might have seen this on Facebook or on the internet, I don't know. There was a professor at a Lutheran seminary. I almost said cemetery. Seminary. And that was not intentional, I promise you. Although you may... He has been removed from his role as a professor, and the denomination is now moving to defrock him. Three primary reasons. One, he is pro-women's ordination. Two, he wants us to be tolerant towards same-sex relationships. And three, he thinks there may be some figurative meaning in Genesis 1 and 2, and it's not exactly literal. For those three things, he has been removed from his teaching post, and they're trying to have him completely removed from the church. I don't know all the ins and outs of it, but my point is, none of those have to do with who God is, who Jesus is. The things that the minds of Athanasius and all the big scholars of the first 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 centuries wrestled with and struggled with, and the problem is, we think we've got God figured out. We live in a time where we have already created the God that we want to follow. The problem is, I would suggest to you that he is probably a capitalist. He's probably a militarist. He is definitely a nationalist, and chances are he's Republican. And we have kind of made this image. So he endorses us, he endorses our way of life, and he protects that at all costs. Now, what this does, though, this creates a religion that is more set on philosophical or political ideologies And it takes the emphasis, or I might even want to say the distortion. It makes the distortion, whatever group is creating their particular view of God, that becomes the emphasis for that particular way we see Him. So it kind of leaves us with this God that actually isn't all that big. There's a book called The Mountain of Silence. It's like the greatest introduction to Orthodox spirituality that you could read. And this guy who's a sociologist, Kyriakos Markadis, is over on the island of Cyprus, and he's with this guy called Father Maximus. And Father Maximus was a monk on Mount Athos, which is like this little island off of Greece that's nothing but monasteries, and women aren't allowed there, and most people aren't allowed there, and these guys are just like really into Orthodox monasticism. And he has moved to Cyprus to kind of renew spirituality on the island of Cyprus. So Markadis, through a whole series of events, makes contact with him and starts traveling with him. And really, the book is just a series of conversations between Markadis and Father Maximus. And they're talking about the nature of God and how we see God. And this is what Markadis comments at one point in their conversation. He says, most believers are in fact blind believers, or as you call them, religious ideologists. That is, they believe in the ideas about God that they themselves concocted that may have little to do with God. No wonder there are so many problems with religion, so much religious fanaticism. And I would suggest to you that we live in a day where we don't make the idols with our own hands. We don't carve the wood. We don't take the stone and make our idols. But as Michael Card suggested in a song a long time ago, he said, we've made you in our image, so our faith's idolatry. And we kind of just keep bringing God down to our size so that we can understand Him. But against this, you have this whole concept of mystery, of this big perspective of a God that we can't quite fully get our heads around. Callistos Ware makes this statement. I love this comment. It is not the task of Christianity to provide easy answers to every question, but to make us progressively aware of a mystery. God is not so much the object of our knowledge as the cause of our wonder. The more we begin to get the vastness of God, the more we begin to understand just how incredible He really is and all that He has for us. Now, I'm going to throw two kind of weird words at you, and I'm not going to use them a lot, but they're going to come up in a couple of quotes, so I just want to make sure you know where we're going, and you can use these at work this next week and impress all your friends. There is a theology that is primarily in the Western Church called cataphatic. Be sure to use that during lunch tomorrow. And what basically the gist of it is, we know God by learning more and more about who He is and how He works and what He does, and we kind of explain everything. Probably the ultimate cataphatic group, if you want, are the Calvinists, who have really tried to detail every single reason why God does everything He does. Then on the Eastern side, you have what is called apophatic theology. This is much more what we're going to be talking about tonight, and it basically says the more we realize that what we don't know about God, the more we actually begin to know God. I told you there's some serious paradox going on here. This is the way Vladimir Lossky defines it. He says, negative theology is not merely a theory of ecstasy. It is an expression of that fundamental attitude which transforms the whole of theology into a contemplation of the mysteries of revelation. Apophaticism teaches us to see above all a negative meaning in the dogmas of the church. Here's the point I would like to make. It forbids us to follow natural ways of thought and to form concepts which would usurp the place of spiritual realities. For Christianity is not a philosophical school for speculating about abstract concepts, but is essentially a communion with the living God. In other words, the more we begin to realize we don't know everything, not by a long shot, so stop arguing about every single little point that you think you've got figured out, and you take a step back and start looking into the mystery and the vastness of this God, you begin to actually move into a relationship and knowledge of God that goes way beyond what you can comprehend with your own mind. The early church fathers looked at the stories of the Old Testament kind of as their basis for this. Abraham was the first one. He was told to leave his place of birth and go to, he didn't know, a place that God would show him. And he would then begin to have it all revealed, and it would begin to open up. Gregory of Nyssa talks about Moses, and as he talks about the spiritual progression of life, he talks about how we go from light to darkness, using the big experiences of Moses. First of all, Moses encounters God at a burning bush. There's lots of light there. It's this amazing experience. Moses doesn't really get a lot of it, but he gets enough that he knows he's supposed to do something. He does his thing in Egypt. They all leave. They're on their journey. And then he comes to this place where he begins to follow the pillar. Sometimes it's light, sometimes it's dark. It's there in the daytime, it's there in the nighttime, but it's taken a little more faith and trust to walk with this, because it's not quite as clear as it has been before. And then finally Moses comes to what the fathers called the thick darkness. And it's at this place where he asks to meet God face to face. And in that moment where it seems like he can't see anything, where things have kind of gone dark and to us, that's where he encounters God in the closest way that he ever could. And in this development, there's a sense that we actually move into darkness or an unknowing, and in that, we actually begin to understand who God is. I told you this is paradoxical stuff. But there is this growing awareness that God's bigger than my understanding. He's bigger than just the moment that I'm in. And I start to rest in that because it's bigger. And in the 5th or 6th century, Pseudo Dionysius prayed this prayer that we looked at, and he opens his book on mystical theology with these words: Trinity higher than any being, any divinity, any goodness, guide of Christians in the wisdom of heaven. Lead us up beyond unknowing and light, up to the farthest, highest peak of mystic scripture, where the mysteries of God's word lie simple, absolute, and unchangeable in the brilliant darkness of a hidden silence. Amid the deepest shadow, they pour overwhelming light on what is most manifest. Amid the holy unsensed and unseen, they completely fill our sightless minds with treasures beyond all beauty. It's like, take your best shot at understanding this as much as you can, and then know God's 10 levels more. And be okay with that. Even begin to rest in that, knowing that that's where he's going to meet you. In ways that you may not be able to articulate, you may not be able to write it down exactly, but you begin to encounter the living God beyond what you and yourself are ever able to actually come up with in your own thinking, in your own thought processes. And I guess, just like Losky said, it goes beyond the theory of ecstasy. We've moved beyond just mental to spiritual. And we're moving into something now that begins to take us further, where it's becoming more than just a belief system, but it's becoming a life of communion with God. But there is this place where God is hidden. There's this darkness that we don't always completely understand everything that's going on. And the reality is we encounter that more often than we may even want to say, where we're just, I don't really get it, but I know that it's God's God. John of Damascus explained it this way. And some of this, it kind of makes me laugh, his language. God then is infinite and incomprehensible. And all that is incomprehensible about him is his infinity and incomprehensibility. Kind of stating the obvious there. All that we can say cataphatically concerning God does not show forth his nature, but the things that relate to his nature. God does not belong to the class of existing things, not that he has no existence, but that he is above all existing things. Nay, even above existence itself. For if all forms of knowledge have to do with what exists, assuredly that which is above knowledge must certainly be also above essence. And conversely, that which is above essence will also be above knowledge. What's he trying to say? He's like, hey, God is just really, really, really out there. And there's just so much of him. And we think we've got him understood. And then he goes beyond that. And we think we want to compare him to stuff. We can do that. We can call him love or power or our Father. And all those things are great words. But he then goes infinitely beyond anything that we can say he is. So there's just this vast awareness that even when we know him, he still is hidden from us in some way. And I would say that what happens is we're face to face with eternity. We have this sense that we have come face to face with the infinite. And what should happen is that this brings us to a sense of humility and awe, because God is just so much bigger than our understanding. And when we begin to get to this place, we no longer feel like we have to explain every event. We don't have to use the phrase every time, well, God has a purpose in this. Especially if you're talking to somebody that's just lost a child or who has just been lost family to a car accident or something like that. Believe me, the last thing they want to hear is God had a purpose in taking their family members. God's bigger than us having to explain him. We don't have to defend him because he's this infinite God that goes so big. And we begin to realize that he, in the vastness of all this, he's chosen to make himself known, but not maybe in such a way that we can cover with our finger, that we can fully sense and understand it. I was talking to somebody in California, a friend of mine who's getting ready to go on a mission trip. She's younger, and she's just kind of starting to understand this Trinitarian stuff, and we've been talking quite a bit, and she was telling me that part of the team has just kind of started dropping off, and one of the other members told her, you know, I really been praying about this, and I feel like God is telling me that the people are going to have something really significant happen to them, and that's why God's taking all the other people away. And she said to me, the only answer I could come up with was, well, maybe. And she said, is that okay? And I just started laughing. I was like, yeah, that's really okay. That's the right answer. But we have been grown up that, oh, maybe's not a good answer. We have to know. We have to stand on the word. We have to be assured. And there are some times when the best we've got is maybe. And we live in that. But see, what she went on to say then is, I'm realizing that God's so big, so I'm okay with that now. Because my assurance is not that I know what's going on, but that I know who he is. And I'm living in the mystery of that, and I'm realizing that. Now, this doesn't work well for post-enlightenment Western society. We get mad at the weathermen if they don't tell us, if they get wrong, what clouds are where. We want to know what's going on with everything all the time. But we don't always have neat answers to the issues of life. Like Gregory Boyd says, sometimes we want to know exactly what God's doing or why he did it. Well, throw in the fact that we live on the same planet with 7 billion other people, and there are all these variables going on around their lives, just there are around your lives, and sometimes stuff just happens. And we have to live in that realization, but that means that God is still God. He's all that he needs, he wants to be for us. And so we start to realize with a sense of humility and a sense of awe that we are coming in front of God. we're dealing with somebody much bigger than us. I think that's why in 275, the opening line of the Liturgy of St. James, and we know the song, "Let all mortal flesh keep silence, and with fear and trembling stand." Because I know these guys saw, hey, this is really, really something. And there are really not words that we can put together three or four lines, and it's going to be catchy, and it'll be fun, and then we'll have God described. But it's just kind of like, wow, here he is. But I would suggest also that hiddenness, knowing God, leads us to a place of desire. This is a statue by Gian Bernini. It's called The Ecstasy of St. Teresa, and it's based on a statement out of a book by Teresa of Avila. And I'm not quoting this exactly, but in essence, she talked about the fact that she encountered God in such a way that a spear of love went through her heart and into her spirit. And from that moment on, she could do nothing but love God more and more and more. And I think this is what begins to happen. As we begin to realize the vastness of God, we begin to realize this is a love relationship that is unending. You may have heard a phrase that's starting to be thrown around called the Dones, D-O-N-E-S. These are people, and apparently this is a growing trend, and we have a couple people in the church who have talked to us about friends of theirs who are exactly these people. These are people who have been in the church for years and years, often in leadership positions, and they're leaving the church. And when you talk to them, it's like, you know, I've heard all the Father's Day sermons there are to hear. I've heard all the Mother's Day sermons there are to hear. I know every possible answer to my relationship problems. I know how to control my finances. And I've got to have something more. I can't do the circuit again and again and again. And it's like, God is only this big. I don't know how else I can explore him based on what I'm hearing here. So I don't know what else to do. And I would suggest to you that when we begin to understand the vastness of God and when we begin to embrace the mystery of this infinite being, then that love relationship goes on and on and on. And every day he's bringing something new. Every day he is taking us deeper and deeper into his limitless, unconditional love that allows us to just keep developing and growing and become more and more of what he wants us to be. Two guys describe this better than I ever could, so we're just going to look at them. Back to Gregory of Nyssa in his book on the life of Moses. He takes us to this point where Moses is encountering God in the darkness. And he says, "Then Moses saw God in light," this before, "now he enters the darkness, leaving behind him all that can be seen or known. There remains only to him the invisible and the unknowable, but in this darkness is God. For God makes his dwelling there where our understanding and our concepts can gain no admittance. Our spiritual ascent does but reveal to us ever more and more clearly the absolute incomprehensibility of the divine nature. Filled with an ever-increasing desire, the soul grows without ceasing, goes forth from itself, reaches out beyond itself, and in so doing is filled with yet greater longing. Thus, the ascent becomes infinite, the desire insatiable." This is so much more than you've said the sinner's prayer, you've been baptized, you've got your seat in the third row, show up every week, try to tithe, and we're good. This is like it just keeps going. It just keeps going. There's more and there's more and there's more that God wants to bring us into. And we are all called to move into that life where we don't understand all the details, where we do sometimes have to set aside our concepts and our understanding And sometimes we say, oh, well, I've always done it that way, or that's what I was taught since I was a kid, but this looks a little different. And God just keeps getting bigger. And we begin to walk in the way with Him. And I would close with this. Kalistos Ware talks about the paradox of spiritual growth. And he says, advancing on the way, each find that God grows ever more intimate and ever more distant, well known and yet unknown. Well known to the smallest child, incomprehensible to the most brilliant theologian. God dwells in light unapproachable, yet man stands in His presence with loving confidence and addresses Him as friend. God is both the end point and the starting point. He is the host who welcomes us at the conclusion of the journey, yet He is also the companion who walks by our side at every step upon the way. As St. Nicholas Kabasilas put it, He is both the end at which we rest for a night and the final end of the journey. There is this place of unknowing where we find rest, because we are communing with the God of infinity, the God of eternity. In every way, He is vast. He just continues to become more and more to us. And I think there is a reality too, the closer that we get to Him, the more we enter the realm of maybe. Well, I don't know exactly the answer. Shane and I, when we had to do our theology review for some people, I think it frustrated them the amount of times we were like, we really don't know where we stand on that. God's bigger than our conceptual answers on things. And people that are looking for something more to life need something more than just another quote-unquote opinion on a particular subject. So I invite you to begin to walk with God in this sense of mystery. We're going to talk more next week about the way God does reveal Himself in the Trinity, in the Incarnation, but that even those are really, really big mysteries. That even in the stuff that we think we completely understand, there's just more and more that we go, wow, that's pretty cool. But at this point in God's dealing with us, He wants to bring us into a place where we kind of take a risk. We step out a little further into the darkness. We walk a little bit more into the fog, knowing that we are encountering the vastness of the eternal God. To finish this off tonight, I would ask you to just stand with me, and we're going to pray this prayer together. This is from Dmitry of Rostov from the 18th century. If you would, come, my light, and illumine my darkness. Come, my life, and revive me from death. Come, my physician, and heal my wounds. Come, flame of divine love, and burn up the thorns of my sins, kindling my heart with the flame of thy love. Come, my King, sit upon the throne of my heart and reign there, for thou alone art my King and my Lord.